Hello and welcome to Two Peds in a Pod, the Paediatric Medical Education Podcast. Remember, you can hear our entire back catalogue of episodes on iTunes, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Amazon Music, and of course, our SoundCloud. So please tell your colleagues and friends and hit that subscribe button. I hope you enjoy today's episode.
Hello and welcome to Two Peds in a Pod, the Paediatric Medical Education Podcast, in association with Peruki, the Paediatric Emergency Research across UK and Ireland group. I'm Ian Lewins, the host as always, and we're very pleased to be joined today by Dr. Etin Bakumana, who is an emergency medicine doctor, doctoral fellow and PhD candidate at Queen's University Belfast. Good morning, Tims. How are you?
Morning. Delighted to be here.
Oh, it's really nice to have you. And today we are going to be talking about FIDO, which has been your life for the last couple of years, probably.
Yeah, definitely. all things febrile infants. I think even my family are tired of me now at this stage.
Okay. And you, that's the FIDO study has recently been published in The Lancet, sort of a couple of weeks ago now, which is brilliant news. So let's talk FIDO. And with every study, you've got to start with an acronym. So FIDO, what does FIDO stand for?
So acronyms are great, they're catchy, and they kind of help in terms of dissemination as well. So FIDO stands for the Febrile Infant Diagnostic Assessment and Outcome Study. And that's essentially it.
Okay. So this answers or seeks to answer one of the really important questions in paediatric emergency medicine, which is the young baby who's got a temperature, who looks well, what do we do with them?
Yeah, so this is one of the, I think across the globe is a challenge for all clinicians of varying stages and ages in trying to make that decision of what to do with that febrile infant. I know there's a lot of guidance across the globe, with some being conservative and some being a bit more liberal, but that's only in the last maybe kind of 5 to 10 years. But that evidence was probably lacking from a UK and Ireland perspective, and that's where FIDO came in.
Okay. So it's seeking to answer a few questions, and as you say, it's looking at these clinical decision aids that we have to sort of, I guess it was to try and work out which one is the best. Is that fair enough?
Yeah, which one is the best? And I think the best at identifying those who we were comfortable saying their risk of invasive bacterial infection was so low that we didn't need to, you know, do an LP or give them antibiotics or get them admitted to the hospital, or even if they're admitted, you know, just admit for observation. Because all these interventions and treatments do have their effects, particularly on young maturing immune systems as those that the febrile infants will have.
So it's really looking at a sort of, a tailored and bespoke approach to these infants rather than, I think, which is potentially a sort of slightly old-fashioned approach, which is if you even sniff of a temperature, you get the works, you get everything done and thrown at you, and you get the antibiotics and you get an LP and blah, blah, blah. And actually, maybe that's not necessarily the best approach for all of these children.
Exactly. The evidence mostly has come from the US and parts of Europe, and which is characteristically shown that, you know, even the rates of invasive bacterial infection over the last maybe 10 to 20 years, particularly with the advent of better maternal care, vaccinations for like hemophilus influenza and others as well, that the rates of invasive bacterial infection, which we're talking about here, bacteremia meningitis, has really kind of declined. And that, you know, the organisms that are more prevalent now would be things like E. coli, for example, and Staphylococcus aureus. So the main idea there is that if you're having declining invasive bacterial infection rates. And let's say out of 100 infants, you know, you're saying a rate of around 1 to 4%. You know, are we over-treating all these infants just to make sure we catch that 1 to 4%, which is important. Mm-hmm. However, there's implications for that, like, you know, even for the family, having their infants stay, the stress or the anxiety the parents have to go through. And then even for the hospitalization costs and things like that to the service itself. So the all this brings around to saying why did we want to do FIDO was really to improve antimicrobial stewardship among clinicians and increase parental confidence in terms of how we manage them, you know, so they understand that these are the risks or this is what's going on. And then really to decrease that hospitalization rates and decrease variation in care and, you know, decrease kind of antibiotic prescription, which in turn would kind of be good from an antimicrobial stewardship point of view. So that's why we embarked on this, really.
Okay. So how did you go about it and how were Peruki involved?
So very fortunate to work with my supervisor, Tom Waterfield, who really was an inspiration, particularly kind of with the project. And we had kind of written up a draft protocol, submitted it to Peruki, and they had reviewed it as well and saw it worthwhile that this was a project that would be beneficial to the network to do. Because it was going to answer some important questions that, you know, would affect practice and clinical care. So that's how I got involved and how Peruki got involved.
So this is an observational study, isn't it, across centres in the UK and Ireland. Mm-hmm. And what was the sort of the cohort that you were looking to recruit?
The cohort we're looking to recruit were infants who had a measured temperature within 24 hours presenting to an emergency department or an assessment unit within UK and Ireland over the kind of time period we're doing the prospective observational cohort study.
And that sort of worked out sort of about 13 months, 16 months, something like that?
It was over a 13-month period. Where we did from July, where we did from July 2022 up to August 2023.
Yeah. And you're looking at, so your primary outcomes really are looking at the four clinical decision aids. Can you talk us through those?
So the primary outcome we wanted to see was that identification of a low-risk cohort. And the rates of invasive bacterial infection and urinary tract infection within those cohorts as well. The four clinical decision aids we ended up looking at were, first of all, within UK and Ireland, we have the NICE guidance, Fever Under 5, which is commonly used across many sites and centres, particularly when we surveyed sites and centres that were participating in the FIDO study. And the other one, which is a bit newer, which is the British Society of Antimicrobial Chemotherapy guidance, called BSAC, and which, again, both of them have a bit of tailored care. And then the other two we're trying to look at were two international ones, which was the Aronson criteria and then the American Association of Pediatric, American Academy of Pediatric guidance for febrile infants. Now, the characteristic thing is all this for clinical decision aids were that they didn't require procalcitonin to be used in terms of application. Only the American Academy of Pediatrics guidance actually gave the leeway to use either a CRP approach or a PCT approach. And we know that in UK and Ireland, we do not have PCT readily available to our fingertips to be able to use in the evaluation of febrile infants. So when we're looking at this, we're looking at things like clinical decision aids we could readily apply to our cohort and that could use. And just to stress an important point was we say we use the word apply because when we're talking about validation has to happen in exactly the same parameters or cohorts for you to really call it a validation. So, and we know that practice across UK and Ireland would be different from places like Europe and Spain or in the US. Therefore, we wouldn't be able to respectfully say that we'd be able to represent that course. So that's why we use the term apply them to our own cohort to see how do they work, essentially.
And that's a really important point, isn't it? Because there's no point saying this clinical decision aid is amazing, but nobody's got the tests that they can apply to it. And I think that's sort of, you know, as you say, quite rightly, where procalcitonin comes in, that some centres might have it, but actually the vast majority of places won't have it. So it's no point us saying this is the absolute right thing to do at this point in time if centres don't have it.
Yeah. So.
So primary outcome is looking at the accuracy of these clinical decision aids in these children, looking at sensitivity and specificity, et cetera, et cetera. Any secondary outcomes that the study looked at?
So I think the major secondary outcomes was to look at the way these infants were managed. We also wanted to find out the cost mm-hmm. of this clinical decision aids, for example, meaning that, you know, if we were to apply these clinical decision aids, how much would they cost? Because I think it's really so as to really inform that whatever one was the best, you know, was it cost effective in terms of application compared to like a treat-all approach, for example. So those were the kind of the major secondary outcomes we were looking at as well.
And I think you also looked at sort of some of the clinical predictors for serious infection as well, which I think is interesting, which is including things like sort of clinical gestalt and what other clinical predictors were you looking at?
So we looked at a host of clinical predictors, but this was really based on, we kind of scoped the literature to look at the different clinical decision aids that existed and the different variables that were used as predictors of invasive bacterial infection. And we kind of mapped that out within our data collection form. So this helped us collect a range of clinical variables that, you know, clinicians can readily obtain to say, were they able to predict the risk of invasive bacterial infection? Now, what we were looking for was something that didn't rely on investigations, where if the clinician had asked this couple of questions or done this clinical exam or included that gestalt, would tell us, okay, the risk of invasive bacterial infection was so high that they needed investigations and workup. Whereas if those, let's say we produced the criteria and that criteria said, look, the risk is very low, then maybe that might obviate the need for kind of significant investigations or such. So we looked at that, those clinical predictors as well.
Okay. So when you recruited over this period of time, I think about 1,800 babies, is that correct?
Yes.
It's off that round. And you then looked at, you know, what happened to these children. And I think it's about 2/3 ended up getting antibiotics, slightly yes. more, about 77% got admitted, mm-hmm. With 14-ish% being sort of discharged and ambulated. And so it's useful to sort of see no child died, important to say. Mm-hmm. A small number, about 1%, ended up going to PICU. So you were able to follow all those children up and get an idea of what happened. But I guess what people really want to know is which performed best. So when you looked at it, what were the outcomes?
So the outcomes for the performance of the clinical decision is when we apply them to our cohort were that the American Academy which of Pediatrics Guidance for Febrile Infants, which was from henceforth, they'll say AAP.
Yes.
So the AAP with CRP, and the BSI guidance, which is a UK-based guidance, performed really well in terms of sensitivity, only misclassifying one infant each. And those two infants presented with a fever of less than 6 hours, right? So I think that the caveat here is that if you're applying this, infants less than 6 hours will be the ones you just be a bit cautious with and maybe observe them for a bit longer. But bar that, they had sensitivities around 99%, yeah.
And I think it's worth reiterating that point is the children we just maybe should be slightly more cautious about here are the ones where they've just had a fever in the last few hours, as opposed to, as you say, that sort of 6 hour cutoff point.
Exactly.
Okay. So that's the BSAC and the AAP.
That's the BSAC and the AAP. Yeah.
How about Nice and Aronson?
So Nice and Aronson also had sensitivities kind of above the 90% range, with Nice being 93% in terms of sensitivity and then Aronson being 90%. But the interesting thing was that compared when you look at their specificity, Nice and Aronson had better specificities in terms of 27% and 30%. So they were able to identify, you know, a low risk cohort of between kind of 27% to 30%. Whereas for the BSAC and AAP with CRP, they identified cohorts of around kind of 20% to 23%. So meaning that, you know, the BSAC and AAP would discharge you know, at least 20% of your when applied, would be able to discharge about 20% of your febrile infant cohort, whereas Nice and Aronson would discharge around kind of 25% to 30% of your cohort as low risk. But the issue there was that the Nice and Aronson misclassified 5 and 7 infants each. And I think the reason for that was BSAC and the AAP CRP depend on CRP, which is a better biomarker. Like PCT and CRP are good biomarkers for infection. However, we know that biomarkers such as white cell count and ANC alone in febrile infants are not as good as CRP and PCT. So I think that characteristically is one of the things that would have caused the misclassification of the Aronson and Nice guidance.
And just sort of thinking about that, there were some children that were excluded. So children with comorbidities, so I think it's about 250, 260 kids with comorbidities were excluded. But the sensitivities and specificities of those clinical decision tools
didn't change,
which is, I guess, is useful to know. Yeah.
So we did sensitivity analysis because in other countries, for example, like in the US or in parts of Spain, infants with comorbidities would be classified as high risk, so they would automatically get investigated. And the thing is that a lot of the data didn't really look at them in terms of what will happen if you just had them included in the whole cohort. Would that performance be obscured because of being termed as high risk? So What we tried to do in sensitivity analysis was to exclude them, so include them first and then exclude them and see what is there any difference in the performance. And when we excluded them, there was no significant difference in the performance of the clinical decision aids, whether it was the AAP, the BSAC, Nice or Aronson.
So that's really interesting to know. Those are your primary outcomes, comparing the sort of the four tools, looking at the sensitivity and specificity. If I were to slightly put you on the spot and say you've got to choose one of those clinical decision tools to take forward in your emergency department, which one would you pick?
So I might have a slight bias to that question, but I think I would pick the BSAC. And the reason for that was more, for reason for me thinking about that is, it's already readily available within our own as a part of UK guidance, right? It's not Nice, but it's already available as UK guidance, which you can follow, right? And this has been developed through evidence synthesis by a group of experts, not only pediatric emergency medicine, but infectious disease. So seeing that it has actually worked within our own cohort is actually really fantastic. And I think if we were to go for that, I think it would be the BSAC that I would go for. And then when we looked at the, like one of the secondary outcomes, like I've discussed, looking at the cost, the mean cost for all the clinical decision aids was better than a treat-all approach. So that included whether you used the BSAC, used the AAP, or used the Nice or the Aronson. However, because of the Aronson and the NICE identified a larger cohort of low-risk infants, the cost was much lower compared to the others or compared to the treatment approach. So balancing everything, like the AAP guidance and the BSAC guidance, would be as cost effective compared to a treatment approach. And then when you look at their sensitivities, they were just better. So that would be the two that I would be looking out for, but BSAC probably because it's already available for us.
Okay, perfect. And then thinking about secondary outcomes, you guys looked at how many, what percentage of children had invasive bacterial infection. What sort of rate did you find?
So the rate of invasive bacterial infection in our cohort was 3.7%. So when we broke it down, that's about 67 infants. Now, 62 had bacteremia and 9 had meningitis. And 4 had kind of concomitant meningitis and bacteremia together. And the predominant organisms were E. coli, GBS, and Staphylococcus aureus, which I kind of is in keeping with the current literature as well. So that was reassuring that the cohort we recruited kind of mirrors what's in the literature as well. So that was reassuring to us that what we're, the cohort we had is similar to what's in the literature, and that when we applied this clinical decision aids, they performed as they did.
And that's really useful that you're sort of not getting an unusual population. It's kind of fitting with what we would expect to see. I think the really interesting bit, another interesting bit, are that these risk factors for invasive bacterial infection that you guys came up with. Can you talk us through those?
So what we did was we initially did the univariate analysis and looked at all those clinical factors like we discussed that we had obtained on our clinical on our data collection form based on all the prior clinical decision aids. And when we looked at it, other univariate analysis, we now did a multivariable analysis, which now kind of honed it down to the things that we're able to predict invasive bacterial infection. And what we found were that if the child had no rash, no unwell contacts at home, or no cough or respiratory symptoms, and the clinicians gestalt was that invasive bacterial infection was likely, that the risk of that child had a higher risk of invasive bacterial infection. So that's what we came up with. The interesting thing was that if you were to apply, what we did is we now looked at saying if a child had, for example, had a cough, had a rash, had unwell contact at home, so if the child had no unwell contacts, no rash, coryza, and the clinician thought IBI was likely, that would identify almost about kind of 90-something% of the cohort, 100% of the cohort that had IBI. However, the specificity was quite low, and it was around kind of 4%. Therefore, if you were to apply this to every infant that came, as in before you did investigations, it would be able to identify maybe a 4% population that we could say might not need investigations or might just need observation. So that's what we found. Now, the clinician gestalt is, I think, is because of the about 60% of up to 60% of the clinicians who have 67% of the clinicians who evaluated these infants were senior clinicians. So that'd be like a registrar, a consultant, or senior clinical fellow. So that might indicate why gestalt worked very well within that model.
And you know, I think that's something that we are sort of seeing when we're looking at sepsis screening for other children, not just the young children, that clinical gestalt is not a bad performing tool. So our spider sense of this child looks unwell, it does tend to perform quite well. Okay, so you you've looked at it, what's the rate of infection, you've looked at your risk factors, and you've looked at your costs, and you've produced your advice on which are the tools that are the most useful. I guess the next question with any research always ends when it's written up, it always says further research is needed. What further research do you think is needed in this area?
I think the FIDO study looking at the performance of these clinical decision aids has shown that, you know, non-PCT based clinical decision aids can be applied, or tailored care can be applied within our cohort. So we probably can start moving away from a treat all approach. So that's one. The next area of further research really is probably applying the clinical decision aids with PCT. Mm-hmm. We did compare the AAP with CRP and PCT, and we found no difference within the study. But further research will be looking at applying things like the PCARN and the step-by-step clinical decision aids, which are quite, which are quite common, quite known. That'll be the next step. The other thing is looking at infants with viral infections and how does that affect our change in practice, or should we change our practice? The other group where future researchers, you know, I think we should look at is those who have had vaccines, because there is some evidence out there saying that those who have had recent vaccinations within, you know, 24 to 72 hours, the risk of invasive bacterial infection is almost negligible. Mm-hmm. So I think that's probably something else that we could look at, because if you are able to identify those infants with viral infections or vaccines who are low risk, maybe it might be a thing that's an added value.
Yeah.
And then you'll be able to either observe or discharge more infants home who do not need extensive evaluations, thus to say that, look, they're fine and well. And part of the FIDO study also did a qualitative aspect where we looked at communication between parents and clinicians and parental values. And parents have said, like, if the clinician is happy and the clinical decision aid says they're low risk, they're happy to really follow that, you know. So, and parents don't want extensive investigation, particularly when they feel, or, you know, the clinician feels it's not needed. So, I mean, if they're supporting tailored care, then I think we have a duty to try and give them tailored care as well.
That's really interesting, because it's about accepting risk and the explanation of risk to parents, and what is an acceptable level of risk. And as you say, tailoring that care is really important, rather than, you know, everybody gets the same thing.
Yeah.
So we can read the study in The Lancet, and we'll put a link in the show notes. There's a nice summary of it also on the Don't Forget the Bubbles website as well, which I've seen. This has now sort of occupied your life for say the last few years. What's next for you personally?
I think there's a lot of collaboration that's going to be done after the FIDO study has been published, you know, particularly getting along with our, you know, European colleagues and American colleagues to kind of produce more evidence as to how we can better manage this cohort of infants. And I think that's kind of the future, and looking forward to working in that sphere.
Perfect. And then eventually we'll come up with the 100% sensitive, 100% specific decision tool that everybody will use, and then we'll all be happy.
That sounds like something for Santa to do.
Yeah. Well, yes, with Christmas around the corner, Santa can definitely deliver that. Yeah. That's brilliant. It's a great study. And, you know, you should take a huge amount of credit for this, Tim. It really is a great study, and yeah, shows how well, you know, collaborative studies can work with really useful help for the clinician on the shop floor. And that's really what people want. So, you know, really well done to you. And thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. Just want to say a big thank you to also the study team in Queen's University Belfast, and all the Peruki site leads and nurses who made it possible. It was just such a pleasure to work with such an engaging group. And it was a joy actually to go through the whole process. Yeah.
Perfect. Perfect. Lovely. Well, I shall wish you a very Merry Christmas, and hopefully you'll get some relaxing time over this period.
Same to you too.
Thanks for taking the time to download our podcast this week. If you enjoy our podcasts, please tell your friends and colleagues, and subscribe to us on Spotify, iTunes, Google Podcasts, Amazon Music, and of course, our SoundCloud. Thanks for listening.